Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon to start your week feeling uplifted and optimistic. Let's tap into the universal energy that connects us all. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. Hello and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks for being with me today, with us today, because I am joined once again by the lovely Karen Elkins. She is the founder of Science to Sage, and you can find her at science2sage.com. And today we are interviewing a very special guest, Richard Merrick, and he's going to be coming to Vancouver. When's he coming?
He's not coming. Not yet. What? We should get him to come.
I thought that was the whole reason. Oh, it's just because he's so fabulous.
It is. It's just because he is so fabulous.
Okay. So we're going to be talking with Richard about the things that he does with music and resonance.
And sound. And it's stunning what he has put together.
But it's kind of science-y, right?
Yeah, but you got to remember he was a rock and roll guy when he was young. And so he's been able to synthesize things in ways that make it so easy to understand. And puts things together that you wouldn't think of, but when you do,
cool.
Wow, exactly,
cool.
He's rock one guy, roll. I want to go to his house and live in his living room just for like a day, and I can pick his brain forever, because
awesome.
He's just, yeah, you can weave webs with this guy, he's amazing.
Fantastic. Okay, well, before we bring him up, you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or you might also be listening online at CITR.ca, CosmicDimensions.com, EmpowerRadio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network. And welcome to the show, Richard.
Hi, Marie. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. And hi, Karen. How are you doing?
I'm doing much better after this morning.
Yay!
And my learning curve.
Oh, Richard, you've submitted a 36-page article?
He never submits. I always go to his website and I say, can I, please?
Oh, okay. And she's dealing with all the math. So how is this? I mean, as soon as I hear math, it's just, I see this invisible line go above my head, like, woo, I'm not good with math. So tell us what it is you do.
That synthesizes all these things.
That magically makes it all happen.
Well, you know, the math is just a language, right? And so there's ideas that anybody can really grasp out of everything that I'm working on. And in fact, that's a big part of the goal, is to use the language of music, both the way, you know, orally as we hear it, but also physically as strings resonate and those kinds of concepts for people, to help people understand really universal principles that apply to everything, including our biological structure.
The one thing Richard does that's amazing is you have the equations, but with his equations are these stunning graphics, because he's also a computer geek, and he makes things so apparent with his visual graphics. That's what I actually love about that with the magazine. So I can look at the pictures and I can still grasp the concepts. So thank you, Richard.
Oh, absolutely. Well, here's the way to look at it, is nature counts. It actually counts. And the way it counts is using harmonics. You know, harmonics on a vibrating guitar string. And when a string begins to vibrate, it divides itself up in multiples of two, and then three, and then four, and five, and so on. And that's called the harmonic series. And it's the physics of the harmonic series that holds the key to understanding how we perceive music, and how the planets are organized, and how atoms bond together, and really everything at different scales of nature.
Well, I think you're the first person I've seen that's put it all together in such a simplistic way.
Well, you know, I didn't set out to actually do that. It's one of those things where I guess it was about probably 32 years ago when I was quite young, and I was a little bit frustrated with what I was being taught in school relative to music theory, and it was all based upon these old rules that came from mostly the church, the Roman Church, and then with a lot of exceptions that had been added since those early days, and it kind of just was a hodgepodge. It didn't make any sense to me, and so I just got motivated to try to figure out there. You know, I've been playing the piano since I was 8 years old, and I felt these patterns in everything I was doing. Didn't matter what the music was, I felt these patterns that were that applied universally, but I didn't understand how it worked, or you know, much less how human beings, how I could perceive the music and actually hear this directional pull of some of the chords and some of the intervals, and why was that going on? And so I set out to try to figure out, you know, some sort of a universal theory that would explain it, and that's what got me back into trigonometry. I'd had some in high school, but, you know, you just don't pay as much attention if you don't have a good reason to apply it. Well, here I had this reason to figure out how music was being perceived and how to understand it. And so I developed quite a bit. I mean, you want to talk about math? It was an entire book of nothing but mathematical graphs, and it was a unified theory that helped me explain, you know, musical concepts like cyclofifths and you know, various chords and how they all fit together. But the interesting thing about that, and this is like the late 70s I'm talking about, there was one I sort of stumbled across. I created this grid of waves or circles that had musical, you know, notes mapped onto the visualization. And I started drawing lines symmetrically from specific points, and I noticed that there was something that looked like a face was sort of being shaped in the center of this grid, and it kind of stunned me. And I said, you know, this can't be the way things really work, right? Because if it was, I would certainly have been told this in school. You know, I would have heard it in my science classes or my music classes, or somebody somewhere would say, you know, hey, by the way, these when you geometrically graph musical concepts, you actually get these shapes of, you know, living organisms, you know, people and what have you. And so I showed this to a composer friend, a composer professor, who introduced me to computer engineer at Texas Instruments, and he's a really brilliant guy, and he had just gotten an Apple II computer, and he was pretty fascinated with my ideas, and we sat down and started graphing these things. And that's what got me into the computer industry, was to figure out how to visualize music. And I ended up going into and being involved in sort of the birth of multimedia and digital media and the internet and so forth. And so that was where most of my career was. But all the while, I was still exploring and trying to understand why this geometry would work and how it applied to the human body and the human mind. And that was kind of the foundation of the work that I started from then about, I guess it was about 6 years ago. I sold my last company, and I retired to work full-time on this theory and to write books about it and articles.
Which is on your website, and I was lucky enough to find you through the guys who worked on the Rosalind Chapel.
Yes, now here's an interesting thing. So my first book is called Interference, A Grand Scientific Musical Theory, and it was about, you know, this sort of... it chronicled my exploration of the history of music theory, because I figured, well, okay, the first thing I need to do is to go back in time, walk through, you know, from... I decided to start at Pythagoras because, you know, he's credited with sort of the father of numbers and the Pythagorean theorem and things related to trigonometry, which waves are all about trigonometry. So I started with that, and I walked up through the Middle Ages, you know, through the birth of the Roman Catholic Church, and how the rules were established. They're called canonical rules or canon rules. How they were put into place in 1234 A.D. and how that paralleled, you know, entire history of the church. It seems like they founded many of their principles on ancient harmonic concepts. And then I watched as the Reformation occurred and things sort of started falling apart for the Roman Church a little bit, and so the musicians were going further and beyond these rules for sacred music that the church had created. And and what I discovered in the process was really this the role that harmonic theory and harmonic physics had played in ancient cultures, and how that had been modified over time and eventually and really suppressed in a lot of ways. It was considered pagan, and so we end up with the educational systems and the schools that taught all of us that had really filtered out a lot of the old knowledge and the old information, that everything can be considered a form of music. It was called musica universalis by the Greeks and Pythagoras, but it goes back much, much further than that. I didn't know that in the first book, but having gone through that historical retrospective, I was then able to sort of deprogram myself a little bit in order to be able to pursue the physics side of it. And step by step, I figured out a way to express the geometry and to understand the geometry of music and understand how that was actually encoded in our body. You know, the fact that we can perceive music and feel the chords or the melodies and the direction that they're pulling and how they're tense sometimes and they're resolved other times, or they're consonant and they're dissonant. Well, why is all that? And the answer is actually an amazingly simple thing, that the physics that you see on a single vibrating string, like a guitar string or a cello string, or in the waveforms that a flute would create inside the tube, are the exact same physics that can be found in the human body and the human brain,
Richard,
the auditory system.
Richard, I need to ask you, so how does an understanding, first of all, because I feel like, Karen's read your article, I haven't, so I'm really... Like, I feel like we're jumping in kind of halfway through the conversation here. I want to kind of move back a little bit so that, because if I'm not really understanding why we're talking about this, I wonder if listeners will either. Okay. So on your website, interferencetheory.com, you said that harmonic interference theory represents a major breakthrough in our understanding of music and perception. And it came from a moment of insight 30 years ago. And you also talk about on your site how ancient civilizations based, your theory is that they based a lot of their astrology and their calendar and all of that on harmonics. And so I'm just wondering, how does an understanding of this harmonic interference theory translate into what people can use practically in their daily lives?
Well, So, of course, it depends on what you do in your daily life and for a living or so forth. But the real value of this is to be able to look at the world around you and to see it differently, see it as it actually is. And that is that everything is vibrating, everything is resonating. The structure of trees or plants, the shape of fruit, the shape of your own body or other animals, insects and so forth, can all be understood as a crystallization process, much like a quartz crystal resonates coherently into, a six-sided shape, a hexagonal shape. You have the same thing going on with living things. And in fact, beyond the geometry of life, you also have the same sorts of things occurring throughout society. When you're involved with large groups of people, there are harmonic functions, there are harmonic things, there are things that are resonating in some places and they're damping or resonating less in other places. And you can actually, if you know that that's the way things are organized, then you actually can make better decisions no matter what you do for a living or what your interests are. Richard? And, of course, it affects your perspective of philosophy, your religious perspective, and just overall your empathy and your sympathy with other people and with the environment. I mean, it is a holistic kind of understanding to see everything from a point of view of harmonics and harmonic relationships.
When we go back to understanding many sacred texts, they all say everything begins with sound. Hmm. But everything from sound, as he's talking about, comes from the crystal. But if you even look at your chakra system, it is the same. It is the chakra system is in within your body, but it all resonates on a scale. So you want to talk about that, Richard, a little bit? Because that's something that, you know, music affects it. It affects the colors. It affects, you know what I'm talking about, the whole the whole range. So why don't you explain that?
Okay. Well, your body is a resonating instrument, just like a cello. I mean, that's the way to think of it. In fact, if you look at a cello, you will see the geometry of the body built into it. You know, it has a sort of a lower sort of pelvic area, and it has an upper chest area, and in fact, the it has a neck, which is called the neck, and it has a skull, and in fact, your head, you know, the cranium is organized as a skull or a spiral that spirals in towards, you know, from your neck and around your ears, in effect. That's why your ears are sort of this double helix. Spiral going into your head. You are, in effect, like a resonating instrument. And so when you listen to music, the first thing that happens just in your auditory system is there's this transformation of this outside vibration, composite waves, you know, lots of different waves. Let's say you're listening to an orchestra, and all of those waves are being perceived as a single vibration on your eardrum. I mean, that's pretty amazing when you think about it, that all of those different instruments with all their different harmonic emphasis and timbre and so forth and harmony and rhythms are all being heard as one single thing, one single waveform that's hitting your eardrum and vibrating it.
There's something that reminds me of this weekend in Vancouver. We had the I Can Do It, and Bruce Lipton was speaking, and he was talking about the cell and the self and how the environment, which would be the resonance of wherever you are, you could put it in one the same thing in one Petri dish versus another Petri dish, and because it was literally in a different environment, it created a different shape and a resonance. Mm-hmm. And we actually, like you and I had talked before, this is your own sound box. Whatever you literally take in and what you literally resonate with creates the you.
Yeah.
And so that means you're either your ease or your dis-ease. So with your music and even color and all of these different facets of what I'm going to call geometry, which, you know, I used to think was kind of goofy, but, you know, when you actually begin to understand the shape of nature, you begin to see that these shapes also give off color, give off sound, give off form, and then all of a sudden life becomes really cool. That's what I think is kind of neat when you understand all these things. But it actually reminded me when you were actually, Marie, talking about what was practical. And actually with different resonance, you can actually heal. This is all part, I think, the properties of it. So, you know, there's one perception you have, which I understood one time when I requested something from you. You obviously see the sound in color.
Well, that's another aspect of it. Light within, our visual spectrum is actually an octave, just like an octave on the piano. So the low dark red colors, where, you know, they begin in our visual spectrum, up to the violet or the really high blues, is literally an octave doubling. The frequencies are exactly twice at the blue end as they are on the red end. And so the entire rainbow spectrum that we see, the visual spectrum of colors, maps directly on to an octave in music.
Right.
And if you know how to orient it, how to orient those colors to a particular scale, then you can actually see the color and the sound represented geometrically in the same way.
And like your chakra system.
Yes, and so now apply that to the body. Now, we haven't really talked about this but yet, but the
well,
body
how about
itself...
Richard, let's talk about the body right after the break.
Sure.
Okay, so this is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. We are speaking with Richard Merrick. He is an author, and he's written several books on interference, harmonic interference theory. You can find him at interferencetheory.com. We're also joined by my co-host today, Karen Elkins from science2sage.com. And this is Synchronicity. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. We'll be back with more of the show in just a moment.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing, Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Hearing your band playing on and on and on. Gosh, so loud.
Man, I wish we had a safe place to play music.
Yeah, and shows too.
The Safe Amplification Site Society is a non-profit group dedicated to establishing a legal, affordable, all-ages venue for music and arts in Vancouver. For more information or to get involved, check out www.safeamp.org.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and we're joined by my co-host today, Karen Elkins from Science to Sage, and also Richard Merrick. He is from interferencetheory.com. And Richard, I had to interrupt you to go to a break, but you were just about to talk about the body.
Well, sure. So, again, the body is a resonant container. It's a container. And it, in effect, we can think of it as a liquid crystal, okay? You know, mineral crystals are hard, and so that's what we normally think of as a crystal. But really, you know, all matter is a form of crystallization, and in the case of the body, it's a crystal, primarily a carbon-water crystal. And the geometries that are possible from the carbon and water as it combines is really a mixture of six-fold geometry and five-fold geometry. And so that the way the atoms then bond and, you know, tends to push, you know, whether as it gets into DNA, it puts it into a particular geometry that is can be identified as dodecahedral. It's basically a 12 by 5 or 6 by 5 geometry. And as that expands out into cellular structures, it becomes larger and larger as a particular DNA expresses itself, and the body, whether it's a very small, let's just use an ant as an example, an insect, all the way up to whether it's a sea life or a mammal, birds and so forth, they all express themselves through this carbon-water geometry, and it's all about resonance. You know, how the carbon and the water resonates with each other as the instrument, the body, gets bigger. Yeah. And so this isn't really, this concept is an old, old idea. It was called Musica Humana by the Greeks, or, you know, human music in humans. But modern science has kind of gone the direction of, you know, certainly evolution and identifying the differences and the adaptations of life. But I believe that that's correct. I just believe it's incomplete. I believe that there is a more fundamental guide or template that is underneath the adaptation process of the environment, of life forms in the environment, that are being guided by the possible the only possible geometries at different scales that are available with carbon and water. So the interesting thing about it, of course, is that it's not arbitrary that water and carbon ended up creating life. Carbon 12 in particular is the standard for atomic weight, for measuring atomic weight, and the reason for that is it's the most what's called unbound atom or element in all of nature.
What does unbound mean? Does that mean that it's more flexible?
Yes, it's more flexible. It has the ability to bind with more fundamental elements than any other element in the universe.
Well, Richard, let me ask a question, because what I think is interesting is when you talk about the sixfold nature, one thing that was interesting for me when I was doing my own book, which I thought was kind of interesting, was when I saw the sixfold, you know, when you look at the ancient stuff, it's the shape of the Merkaba.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the Hindu, the culture of the Vedas, you can see it, the same swastika or whatever, the same symbol in there. I look at the crystallized form of a snowflake and it does it. And then the other thing I noticed was your DNA has that same structure, but so does an electrical current and the wiring that we do. So it actually, to me, that is the way we take our DNA, which actually also spins, and how we activate the resonance within our own body, like when Bruce Lipton says you're not your DNA, but it's kind of, to me, the way I figured it, it's like those are the electrical currents that conduct the charge and the resonant into your body that helps form and create the straight the shape and the structure that you are. It literally, we become that light body because of that. That made sense to me.
Absolutely true. And so, the question that you have to say is that, well, okay, then what is light or what is electromagnetism? And so this study of harmonics and sound applies equally to light and electromagnetic waves and any other waves.
Well,
and here's how.
Okay.
When any type of wave of any media, any medium is reflected within a container, when it reflects inside a container, it creates what's called a standing wave or a it just reflects back on itself, and it becomes you have stationary waves that will form in an auditorium or a with amplification. You might hear this as feedback. You know, when you get feedback, that is essentially a standing wave. That's once it sets up, it starts resonating against itself, and it over resonates and creates the screeching sound that you hear with that.
Well, here, hold on one second. Let me pause, because is that like what I see? You know, when people say you're the light body, and then we look at, we get to the part on the periodic table or the light spectrum, and we get down to the densest point. So we're literally dense, the densest matter. So from that perspective, but when we think of the idea of a wave, when I go to the movie theater, and I think, you can put your hand in front of the projector, and you can see that it's just a projection of light that way. And it's not something that we actually think about, but in one sense, when they say we're the projection of light, we are literally taking that transducer, that receiver, that is a sound wave, which we come out with light, and we become in different pigments or whatever, and we're basically still, like you're saying, standing is like, it's like a still frame of a movie, but at the same time, it still has that flexibility. So we're still movable, palatable. When you said that about the way we compose and bond, and that we're flexible, that gives us our free will.
Well, yeah. I mean, these are all different. You're citing different aspects of the same physics, which is the standing wave.
Yeah, but it relates to me, so it makes it personal.
Yes, of course. Yeah, and everybody should do that. Everybody should find a way to connect in. And there's so many different ways, different avenues into this way of thinking, which I call harmonic thinking.
Right.
You know, seeing everything through this unified view rather than the modern scientific reductionist view. It was the ancient view to see everything as a whole, and modern science has been trending to greater and greater fragmentation and reductionism. So to go back to the body, if you see that as a resonator, and a standing wave, but resonance is a standing wave. That's what happens when you pluck a guitar string, is it resonates.
Okay.
And it creates all these harmonics. They're actually vibrating with that string. You only hear the fundamental, note, but there are actually other harmonics that and other waves that are there that add timbre. That's what timbre is, or the quality of the sound is shaped by, let's say, the body of a cello or the in the case of electric guitars, it is shaped by electronically, by the pickup and the amplifier and so forth.
But is that also the idea of like resonance, like?
Yes. So we were talking about different forms of waves, and that when they reflect, they will create the same standing wave that you create when you pluck a guitar string. That's why in quantum physics we have something called string theory. It means what it says. It's literally this theory that everything is sort of this part of this long string of vibration. So the body, the reason that we can perceive the pulls and the chords and that they evoke emotions when we hear music is because our body is literally resonating and with the particular sound combinations that's coming in, it's separating them out into their individual harmonic components in the inner ear, and then as it makes its way through what's called the Brodmann area of these concentric rings in the center of your brain, and it works its way in, it is being recognized by your brain as your brain is actually resonating with that sound. Okay? And the way I figured out that it's actually recognizing that is that the geometry of your ear, your inner ear, your eardrum, the basilar membrane on the cochlea, which is the little spiral that's inside your ear,
yeah,
all of these things are expressions of harmonics.
We had Freddie Silva in town this last weekend, and he was talking about the pineal gland, right? He said when it resonates and they're in the temples, because I know your other book has to do with temples, it's the Venus, so you can explain that. But there was something, because he was talking about the portals to paradise and how we get there, and he said the pineal gland, when it's not really awakened, like the serpent, it lies flat. It's like slithering on across the ground. But when you actually awaken the third eye, it literally lifts up and vibrates like a cobra. And did you know that?
Well, it is an eye. It actually has a retina.
Does it? Okay.
And in more primitive animals, like reptiles,
yeah,
they actually have their pineal gland is towards the top of their just underneath the skull, and it picks up light through the skull, and so in a crocodile, for instance, it has its third eye, its pineal gland has a cornea as well.
Wow.
So it's a fully functioning eye at the top of their brain, the crown. That's where the crown chakra concept comes from. Is it's a real functioning a third eye. It's not just a symbol. It's not just a concept.
It's
physical fact.
Well, even Earth has a crown chakra. NASA basically even calls it that, a crown chakra. The North Pole, where you see the Borealis,
mm-hmm,
it's where its crown literally is illuminated. So
yes,
we are the same from that. But okay, Richard, I'm going to be naughty. Explain the blue bloods then. Where are we? Where is the whole idea of the snake in the Garden of Eve and with these little snaglies? How does that all tie in to this pineal gland opening in the third eye? Marie's looking at me like, where are you going?
Where are you going with this?
I have never heard any of this. The brain is like mushy looking. I've seen it in school. I don't see any eyeballs. I dissected an eyeball in high school, and it did not. There was no eyeball in the brain. So I don't know where this is coming from, and I'm very confused.
Well, the pineal gland is a tiny little gland at the. It's not actually in the brain. It's right underneath the brain. Okay, it's actually separated by a sac that holds the brain, keeps out blood and so forth. It's actually outside of that. However,
she goes.
The things that it produces, or that it's believed to produce, and there's a limit to how much people the scientists actually know about this. But it looks like it emits melatonin, and possibly, possibly this what's called the spirit molecule, which Dr. Rick Straussman has written a number of books and done studies on this. It's called, and actually it's a great book that he has. It's called the spirit molecule, but it's the idea that the pineal gland may, in fact, produce and emit these what's called dimethyltryptamine (DMT).
Oh yeah,
which is the most psychedelic compound in the known world for the human mind, and so it's a natural thing produced by the body, and this pineal gland is an atrophied eye. At this point, it looks like a little pine cone. It's enclosed. It doesn't have a cornea, but it does have cones, and it actually receives light from our normal eyes through a little back channel that forks off to that, and that helps regulate things like sleeping and dreaming and so forth.
Wait, that symbol, just because Marie's looking at it, like, I've never heard this stuff. But here's what you'll have seen it. Those structures like the pine cone you'll see at the Vatican court, you will see them in all of the ancient, Assyrians, you will see that they're actually like, it's like a code. It's like you can see them turning it.
Is this like the Da Vinci code we're talking about here?
Well, it's a spiral of life. The pine cone literally spirals in one direction, eight, and the other direction, 13. So when you actually create it, it creates spin. And spin is what generates life. That's what distinguishes life from non-life. So the pine cone is really a very perfect analogy for life. Okay, Richard, I'm going to let you take it from here.
Oh, it's time for a break. So we'll be back with more synchronicity in a moment. I'm Marie Bernard, your host, and I'm also joined by my co-host today, Karen Elkins from Science to Sage. And today we're speaking about interference theory, harmonic interference theory with Richard Merrick. And we'll be back with more synchronicity in about 30 seconds.
Have you heard of the newly opened NSCS Discovery Restaurant at 1515 Discovery in Jericho Park? Profits support NS Culinary Education Society of BC. Enjoy breakfast on the beach for only $4.95, served daily from 7 a.m. till 11 p.m. Say you heard this ad and receive 5% off lunch and dinner items until May 31st, 2012. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, or dinner at the newly opened NSCS Discovery Restaurant at 1515 Discovery in Jericho Park and support a local social enterprise.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I am your host, Marie Bernard, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Karen Elkins from Science to Sage, as well as our guest, Richard Merrick. You can find him at interferencetheory.com. And I love you're standing on your website right outside. This is why I'm asking about the Da Vinci Code and everything. You're standing outside the Louvre with the little pyramid, the glass pyramids there, and now we're talking about the Vatican and the pine cones and everything, and it all sounds very, like, I don't know, interesting and groovy, but I don't understand any of it.
Richard. You mentioned the Da Vinci Code. Of course, what Dan Brown is doing with his books, and even his last book, The Lost Symbol, is he's accessing, like I think a lot of people are doing, different theories of, you know, hidden knowledge. They're looking, you know, and he's looking to craft interesting books to introduce some of these concepts in novel new ways. And what I'm doing, in effect, is sort of uncovering the real Da Vinci Code, if you will, or the real truth behind a lot of those theories. You know, what's really going on? There's a whole lot of theories about, that related to religion or related to esoteric beliefs. Well, all of those do have an origin, and they do have, there is some truth in much of it. And there's, of course, a lot of fiction that's wrapped around it as well, because if you just don't understand, if you don't understand it, then you craft a story to make it somehow make sense for you. Well, So my first book, actually, and I had a second book that was a graphic novelette, those were all oriented around understanding the physics of resonance and how we perceive music, and to develop different models to help visualize those things. Well, as in the process of doing that, I began to get interested in this chapel in Scotland that was actually in the Da Vinci Code, which was Rosalind Chapel. At the end of the Da Vinci Code, the characters end up at Rosalind Chapel, and there's a variety of reasons we don't have time to go into that led Dan Brown to think that was a good destination for his plot. Well, his theory was, as is with other people who have studied this, they believe that there's some connection to the bloodline of Jesus and things like that. Well, that wasn't what caught my interest in Rosalind Chapel. What caught my interest was a press release by a father-son team in Edinburgh, which is only 7 miles from Rosalind, who had actually decoded these resonant symbols that were carved into the inside of the chapel. They called them musical cubes because they were cubes that literally stick out from the arches, and they have carvings of strange carvings that nobody's figured out. This was a medieval chapel built in the mid-15th century, and nobody could figure out what these strange symbols were. And they had found that they were what's called cymatic symbols or cymatic patterns, which are the patterns that sound makes when you vibrate water or in a cup, or you vibrate sand on a plate. Certain frequencies will actually form patterns because, again, they're setting up standing waves in the vibrating medium, which creates these geometric patterns. Well, they found matches in their experiments against these musical cubes, these carvings. And I started communicating with Stuart Mitchell about it, and he was kind of reluctant because he was getting flooded by, everybody was wanting to talk with him about it. But my perspective was I was in the middle of writing that first book on harmonic theory, and I was proposing, I noticed that there were eight dragons carved into the base of one of these front pillars, and 13 angels. Well, there's the 13 to 8, which I knew from my studies was a Fibonacci proportion, what's called Fibonacci series. It was a, which has a lot to do with a lot of esoteric beliefs, but it also has to do with the resonance pattern that Venus and Earth make. Venus goes around the sun 13 times, corresponding to the angels, and the Earth goes around the sun 8 times, corresponding to the dragons, and they meet up at the end of this eight Earth year cycle. And in the process, during those 8 years, they have 5 conjunctions. The 13 to 8 creates 5 conjunctions that actually forms a pentagram around the sun.
It's really pretty.
And if you were to track this or trace Venus over this 8-year period, it would create this rose-like pattern, this 5-petaled rose pattern, which has been called, Rosabel or the beautiful rose, and it is the namesake for Rosalind, which was the rose line. Okay, so the more I got into it, the more I started becoming interested in that building's acoustics because of my interest in harmonics. And I started studying the dimensions and analyzing the acoustical properties, and that's what ended up pulling me into my new book, which is called The Venus Blueprint. And what I've determined was that not only that chapel, but other cathedrals in Europe, as well as very famous temples from everything from the, St. Peter's Basilica at the Vatican to the Parthenon to the Pantheon to even Solomon's Temple of Jerusalem, were all based upon this resonance pattern of Venus, this blueprint. They used the pattern in the sky that Venus creates as a pattern to design their temples, to create holy spaces or sacred spaces. Well, it took a while to get through that, but I just kept asking more and more questions. Well, then why, what was this all about? Well, here's the interesting thing. So I went for the first time. I went, I guess it was now 2.5, 3 years ago to Roslyn, and on a trip with my family, and I met up with Stuart and his father and other people. John Stuart Reed, who's well known for Egyptian sonics and that sort of thing. And we went through the chapel, and I went down into the what's called the sacristy, which is underground. It's the underground part of the chapel, and that was right next to the crypt where they would bury the barons. It was all this was owned by the Sinclair family, and so it was the Sinclair barons that had been buried in the crypt. Well, that's all sealed off, but you can go into the sacristy. And the sacristy, while the chapel itself is very ornate with all these strange, amazing carvings, the sacristy is just a box, and but a very resonant box. And I noticed on the walls that there was these etchings, and other people have seen these etchings and tried to figure them out, and some of them you can figure out, but there was one that has just been very perplexing for everybody who studied that chapel. And it was this strange tower that looked like, etched on the wall, that looked like an oil derrick or an electrical tower, something like that. So what would somebody in the 15th century be doing, you know, etching this strange oil derrick on the wall? You know, there's just no absolutely, so it's such a non sequitur. Well, so whenever I see something like that, I'm perplexed. I've got to try to figure out what it is. And so when I came home, I started studying that, and I discovered that it corresponded to this symbol, this Vedic symbol. You know, before Hinduism, there was the Vedics, and really before all of the ancient civilizations, there was the Vedics, and they had written the Rig Veda. Well, in these, you know, illustrations, these Vedic illustrations, I found this representation that matched that. And the symbol was called Mount Meru. It was a sacred mountain. So I'm wondering, why is a Vedic symbol carved in the sacristy where all the, you know, holy symbols of the church are kept in a Roman Catholic church, right? Mm. Why would there be a pre-Hindu symbol carved into the wall?
Because they're all the same?
Well, the more I explored that, the more I realized that that symbol had to do with the geometry of Venus. And, in fact, all the symbols are related to our Vedic symbols. The chapel was dedicated as a collegiate chapel to St. Matthew. And a collegiate chapel is intended to teach. And so what Roslyn Chapel is really doing is it's teaching us about the ancient origins of Christianity. You know, before the Roman Church, before the Hebrews, you know, before Egypt, before Sumer or, you know, India or China, what was, you know, where did that come from, and what was the inspiration behind all of this thing that we call religion? And that's what Roslyn Chapel is teaching us in a variety of ways, with the symbols, with its architecture. But the thing that really got me, and I'm just kind of rolling on here, but I, you know, want to complete this thought. The thing that I discovered was that the chapel itself had particular resonant qualities. It was designed to, in an acoustic way, to keep standing waves from setting up. And so basically a perfect, you know, acoustical space where somebody could talk or music could play and you could hear it throughout the entire stone chapel, but without any kind of ringing or echo. It was very clean. And the other thing that I noticed is that when you stood and listened to music, because I went back there again to talk, I did a talk at Roslyn Chapel, and there was a concert, and so I positioned myself in the place that I believe that would be ideal. And in fact, what I heard was an amazing thing. the resonance of this chapel was such that the music didn't seem like it was coming from the performers that were right there in front of you. It was actually coming from above you, as if the music is coming down from heaven. You know, that
beautiful.
Was an auditory illusion created by the geometry of the chapel. Well, I started asking myself, why would that be important? You know, I mean, yes, it's a nice symbol that music, you know, is coming down from heaven, but what were the rituals, if you go back in time to the most ancient temples, what were they trying to do with these acoustical illusions? And what I found was that there's this new field called archaeomusicology and psychoacoustics. You know, all these, you know how science will, when they can't answer a particular problem, they may have to merge a couple of different fields. Well, that's what's beginning to happen now in this area of investigating archaeological ruins and ancient temples. Well, what I found was that there is a ritual that was universal, that goes as far back as we can, as recorded history takes us, of communion, you know, taking a communion of some sort in the temple. And before temples, there were caves, and they would actually, like, go to certain caves that would and modify them to create certain resonant frequencies that studies have found actually switch our brain function. It modifies how we think and elevates our consciousness at certain frequencies. Well, I found those frequencies in the structure of Roslyn Chapel, but I also found that these resonant, these rituals that went with the temple, which was the reason for temples in the first place, was related to taking sacred plants, which were essentially entheogenic plants of one sort or another. Entheogen means basically psychedelic, psychoactive. Mm-hmm. So communion used to be psychoactive.
Is this a theory, or do you have evidence of this?
No, there's tons of evidence. There's a lot of books about it. I mean, fairly new books, because of the fact that, you know, information is finally surfacing, and this is an incredible period that we're in. But it was very, very common with the Greeks, the Roman Bacchanalia, the Eleusinian mysteries, the Dionysian mysteries, all the mystery schools, even the Essene school. But then going way back before all of that, it was very common in Egypt. You know, Hathor had her temples of intoxication, and in Babylonia they had the House of the Star for Dagon and Belitu, where entheogenic communion was taken. But it was taken, it was taken by everyone.
Well, that goes back to some of the ancient indigenous cultures that used their spirit
I'm going to have to wrap this up, because we're actually running out of time, because we have a recording that we need to play. So I don't want to, we have about 3 minutes before we have to move towards wrapping up. So Richard, I want to ask you, what's the most important point that you want to get across to people today about harmonic interference theory?
Well, I guess twofold. One is just from a purely physical point of view, and that is that to recognize that our bodies are resonating instruments, and that they are affected by waves of all kinds, whether they're sound waves or light waves or electromagnetic waves, and that we are a liquid crystal that does resonate and can be affected by different frequencies, including our brain. So that would be the first thing. And the way we perceive music then is to measure it with the geometry of our auditory system and our brain, which are manifestations of harmonics. Okay, so then that's the one thing. The second thing is to say that this was known throughout history, very deeply by many cultures, and it was incorporated, became the foundation of religion, that this idea of a this single, really, theory of everything, that everything is a form of music and everything is resonating, was the original concepts behind temple building, behind communion, behind astronomical observations. All of these things were part of a unified theory of everything that we call, you know, religion these days. So that's really, I guess, you know, that you have to get into the details to realize that, oh my goodness, everything from Freemasonry to governments, you know, all of the structures, for instance, of state capitals and the capital of the U.S., all these domed buildings that you see, for instance, in Venice, which is another word for Venus, all of these domed capitals follow the ancient Mount Meru's temple design that goes back many thousands of years, and it was designed to resonate the brain and release the, you know, the spirit from the temple of your cranium, out the crown of your head, out through your third eye. And they used plants, sacred plants.
I'm sorry, Richard, I'm going to have to cut you off. I think what you're saying is completely fascinating, and I would love to continue this conversation, but we are literally beyond out of time. So thank you so much. Interferencetheory.com is your website, and is that where people should contact you if they have more questions?
Oh, absolutely. Then just go there.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time, Richard.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, thank you. I feel bad for having to cut him off, but we're running out of time. And you said that there's a magazine that you have, an online magazine?
Yeah, I do an online magazine called Science to Sage. And I have the one thing that he mentioned was the John Stuart Reed. I have all of them in an issue called Cymatics. And so if they're interested in finding out more, they can go to Science to Sage. The next issue, which is coming out today, is on harmonic evolution. And I have a lot of the top people around the world and many that he's mentioned that are not known to the most people but are incredible.
Wonderful. Okay, so I have to play one more break and we'll be back to wrap up the show momentarily.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
Hi, welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and I'm going to wrap up the show now with a recording from the author of Making Miracles, Lynn Woodland. She wasn't on the show last week because she was in Kuwait teaching a workshop on miracles, and she's going to be in town on
May 25th and 26th.
May 25th and 26th. We're giving away one pair of free tickets to the evening event of May 26th that starts at what, 7:30?
It starts at 7:30 at Unity.
At Unity.
Vancouver.
Okay, so if you want that pair of tickets, the first person to call in, 604-822-2487. That's 604-822-2487. Karen is helping to organize the event, so I will have her put your name on the list. And here is Lynn Woodland closing off the show. Coming up in a few minutes is Parts Unknown, so stick around for that here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Have a great week. Be well. I love you so much. Namaste.
Some people have read my new book, Making Miracles, and see it as a tool for bringing our goals and desires to fruition. Others have read it and compared it to A Course in Miracles, seeing it as a spiritual practice for living in love and releasing separateness. But I think of Making Miracles as an experiment. It turns readers into participants in a miracle-making experiment as soon as they begin reading. It invites them to use intention and imagination to bypass the illusionary boundaries of space and time to reach out in loving compassion to every other reader, wherever they happen to be in space and time. Readers are invited to care deeply about each other. The experiment then involves focusing and directing this collective energy of love to see what miracles we can create for ourselves and for each other and for the world beyond. Essentially, this experiment is a means of gathering people and consequently of building energy for miraculous manifestation. Because we gather outside of time and space, many more people can be together than could easily happen in linear time or in one place. And this creates a field of consciousness, like massively focused prayer that works on behalf of every participant. Now, the people can join beyond space and time and generate energy this way may seem far-fetched. But all the experiments I put forth in Making Miracles are just new applications for what science has already shown or strongly suggested is possible. Many readers have already shared with me their personal stories of wonderful healings and manifestations related to reading the book. But what can't be gauged is the effect we're having on the world. And personally, I see this book as a laboratory for evolving. Part of that evolution means stepping beyond the limitations of linear thinking, of cause and effect, even beyond time in the linear sense. But an even more important aspect of human evolution, I believe, is in realizing and tapping the power we have when we join together for the highest good of all, a power we simply can't get to alone. The experiments in Making Miracles are designed to support the well-being of each person who participates in them, fulfilling personal needs for healing, happiness, and well-being. Yet, the path to all this personal fulfillment is through joining in love and showing up for each other. It teaches us through the experience of our own miracles that we can have more for ourselves and create it more easily when we can lose ourselves, even if just for an instant, to the joy of loving and truly caring about the well-being of others. Using the sale of this book to support a group like SIVA, an organization that makes miracles happen for so many people, delights me because it's such a beautiful demonstration of this principle. As long as one of us is left behind, no one really goes forward. And as we forget ourselves for a moment in the love of each other, miracles happen for all of us. And now, I'll leave you with this brief miracle experiment. Just relax for a moment. Breathe. And bring to mind in your imagination the many thousands of people who have already added their love to the miracle experiment. And now imagine the countless people who will in the future add love and compassion to this experiment. Now, just love them, all of them, with all your heart, just for an instant, through time and space, send to people you'll never meet the faith that miracles are happening. You don't have to believe, just imagine. Your love may be quietly changing someone's life, providing light in a time of darkness, opening opportunities.